You're tuned in to the Kojo Nan, the show on WAMU 88.5. Welcome. Later in the broadcast, how are local jurisdictions doing when it comes to recycling and keeping waste out of landfills? But first, we're celebrating our hometown paper for its two Pulitzer wins.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the announcement of the 2018 Pulitzer Prizes. For investigative reporting, the prize is awarded to the staff of the Washington Post. Purposeful and relentless reporting that changed the course of a Senate race in Alabama.
Joining us now is the executive editor of the Washington Post, Martin Barron. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Congratulations on this honor. There was some extraordinary reporting, including for the story that ultimately contributed to upending the Senate race of Roy Moore, involving all sorts of bizarre twists, including a fake victim who came to the Post aiming to discredit the paper. As the paper's executive editor, were there some tough calls during the course of that story that you had to make?
Well, I think there were tough calls all along the way that had to be made by reporters and by editors. First of all, we had to verify the stories of the women who were making very serious allegations against Roy Moore, the Republican candidate. And there were a number of women. We had to do full vetting of them. And we had to get them to, first of all, give us their names and allow us to use their names. That's something that they decided to do. And then we had to make sure that they told us everything about themselves and anything that could be used against them. And we needed to be aware of that from the very beginning. So all along the way in that story, I think there were some very difficult decisions to be made.
The Roy Moore story came about in part thanks to the Post's Rapid Response Investigative Team, an 8-person unit the Post formed last summer. The news cycle moves so quickly now that all news seems to be kind of rapid response. Marty Barron, why was there a specific need to develop an investigative unit charged with this mission?
Well, the mission, we thought of adding to our investigative team during the presidential election. I think our assumption was that regardless of who was elected president, that there would be a lot of investigating to do. And I think the expectation on the part of the public is that we fulfill our mission of holding our politicians and our policymakers accountable. We felt there was a need for more resources and for us to turn around our investigations more quickly than we had in the past. And they jumped into this story. The story originated actually with Stephanie McCrumman, who was down there working on another story, and she came across someone who told her about a woman who had been pursued by Roy Moore when she was 14 years old, and then after Stephanie started working on the story, we realized very quickly that we needed additional resources. And so the Rapid Response Investigative Team joined that effort.
It's been an incredible year for investigative reporting, but not all papers are investing in such work. It can be costly. It can be time-consuming. So can you tell us why, in your view, investigative reporting in particular at this moment is so vital?
Well, look, first of all, I think it's fundamental to our mission. It's the reason that we have a First Amendment in this country. You know, James Madison, one of our founders, talked about examining public characters and measures. The leading public character is the President of the United States. The measures are the policies that our federal government puts into place, as well as our state and local governments. And so I think the public has come to feel that we need to do a better job of holding our government and our policy, our politicians accountable. And that became true, I think, throughout the presidential campaign and then certainly during this administration as well.
We'll get to more details of the how and why of the investigative unit in a moment with Eric Rich, the editor of that team. But since we have you here, Mr. Barron, the President of the United States has repeatedly in recent weeks called the integrity of the Post into question, including calling it, quoting here, the Amazon Washington Post. What's your response to that?
Well, look, he's been attacking us since the presidential campaign. This is not a new phenomenon. It's something that he comes back to fairly regularly when he doesn't like a story that we've published. I think we've come to expect that. I think the important thing is that our stories are true, that they're verified. That's proven to be the case. These stories are validated, ultimately sometimes actually validated by the president himself within a matter of a day or two. And so you know, if it engenders attacks by the president, that's just part of what the current environment is, and it's not going to distract us or to deter us from doing our work.
Martin Baron is the executive editor of the Washington Post. Everybody in the movie called you Marty, can I?
Yes, absolutely. That's what everybody calls me.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Joining me in studio is Eric Rich. He is the editor of the Washington Post Rapid Response Investigative Team. Eric Rich, glad to have you join us.
Glad to be here. Thanks, Kojo.
Eric, you were named editor of this Rapid Response Investigative Team. Tell us about it and how and why the Post felt it was necessary to develop such a unit. How does it work?
Sure. Well, I mean, as Marty just mentioned, it's sort of investigative reporting is core to our mission as journalists. And we are also in a time now when the news cycle is moving so quickly. It's important to, be able to dig and do some revelatory accountability reporting in that very fast news cycle. Also, I mean, my day-to-day experience is that media is as competitive as it ever has been. I feel like we have competitors doing that kind of reporting all the time, and that's not just the New York Times and the Journal, although it's them, but it's also BuzzFeed and the Daily Beast and all kinds of outlets. So, if we're going to stay in that game and we're going to be able to land scoops on important stories that people are talking about, we need to have the resources and bandwidth to do that.
Tell us about the team. How many reporters on it? How does it work?
Right. So right now there are 8 reporters. So it's me and a data reporter, a graphics reporter, and 6 other reporters who have a variety of backgrounds. Most came out of jobs where they were beat reporters who had a tendency to write sort of what I would call enterprise accountability stories. So, stories that are not just daily news stories, but something a little deeper. One member of our team, Bob O'Hara, came from a more traditional investigative background. He was on the traditional investigative team at the Post before he joined us. So our challenge is to find stories that we can where we can break new ground in an accountability that have accountability dimension that will take a few days or a few weeks at most. I think we started with the ambition of a few days being the timeline that we'd work on. We've found that that's challenging. I think one of your tweets or somebody's tweet this morning about this show mentioned that it's oxymoronic, or it may be oxymoronic, to think about a rapid response investigative team. And it does feel that way to me sometimes, but it also feels so important and necessary to do it. So, we do a lot of partnering with other people around the newsroom. We have a lot of beat reporters who hear things, have good ideas. Maybe they, just need some additional reporting bandwidth. Maybe they need somebody who has some more familiarity with freedom in FOIA rules or other matters like that. And we can help, help get these stories out the door.
Here's Mark in Silver Spring, Maryland. Mark, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Well, thank you. First, I want to congratulate the Post, but a more general point, for all the strict constructionists regarding the Bill of Rights, you just have to read the First Amendment to get to the relevant part is, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. When you put the press in a pen to be jeered at by a crowd, that's abridging the freedom of the press. And I think the Post and Times should feel comfortable to make that point.
And it would appear that they do, Mark. Thank you very much for your call.
Thanks for the call.
Marty Baron mentioned how you got involved in the Roy Moore story because Stephanie McCrimmon ran across somebody in Alabama who talked about it. But you know, as a reporter, especially when you're covering a political story, you'll hear a lot of rumors, you'll hear a lot of scuttlebutt, how many of it coming from opposition camps, as a matter of fact. How do you decide what to pursue?
Right. So, I mean, that's always a challenge and a question. And it's actually an amazing story about how Stephanie heard this. She was 3 hours into an interview on an unrelated topic. And, in today's news environment where reporters and editors are needing to make decisions about where we put our time and how we spend our time, a 3-hour interview is unusual. And, Stephanie stayed with that person until this piece of information surfaced. And then she did some sort of preliminary poking around on it. I believe she made contact with Lee Korfman, who was the woman who had the primary, the most significant, allegations against Roy Moore, and had sort of assessed her to be initially credible. And at that point, she and her editors contacted me and my team, and then we partnered up, realizing there was more to do. And there were a lot of other tips that there were a lot of stories we chased down there, and a lot of them turned out to be untrue. And there were a lot of rumors in Gadsden, Alabama. And Beth Reinhardt and Stephanie McCrumman spent a few weeks down there chasing them all down and talking to many, many people and verifying stories and fact-checking accounts. And, after our story ran, we had more tips that some of which were untrue, including, importantly, the tip that came from the purported tip that came from a Project Veritas staffer, somebody who was trying to dupe us into a fake story about Roy Moore and, get us into interview context where they presumably hoped we would say embarrassing things, which we didn't do.
As a matter of fact, that was one of the questions I had in my mind. How do you ultimately see through somebody like that from Project Veritas?
Yeah, I mean, the Veritas operations have taken different forms, and some are contacts in social settings where reporters have been approached in bars or restaurants or at social events and drawn into conversations, and then those conversations are surreptitiously videotaped and selectively, in some cases, presented. In our case, we were reporting, and so this person who approached us used this person approached us on the day the first Roy Moore story broke, and she used a fake name, and we were able to figure that out pretty quickly because our routine sort of reporting involves fact checking, everything, and so. She gave us a story with a name and a biography, and Alice Kreitz, working with Beth, Alice Kreitz, who's a researcher at the Post, working with Beth, fairly quickly determined that there was nobody existed with that name and that biography, and that sort of put her in a situation, this woman, where she then had to give us her real name. That ultimately is, proved to be her undoing, because with her real name, we were able to learn all kinds of things, and Alice ultimately found a document online, a GoFundMe page that this person had created last summer, wherein she said that she was moving to New York to take a job with a group that exposes bias in mainstream media, and she was raising money for that purpose. And once we found that, we sort of confirmed our suspicions that she was not who she claimed to be, and her story was not, accurate.
So the rapid response investigative team also has to provide a rapid response to the claims of its own potential sources.
Yes, all the time. Yep.
You have said that investigative reporting is experiencing a kind of renaissance. Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, I think it is in some ways. Right now, it feels like there's so much accountability reporting happening, and I know, CNN has hired a bunch of investigative reporters. Some of these digital-only outlets that have emerged in recent years are really doing real investigative reporting, and I feel that all the time when I'm regretting that we didn't finish our stories sooner because they appear on, in The Guardian or somewhere else. So there's a lot of investigative reporting out there, and I think there's also a lot of reader interest in it. I mean, we get a tremendous response from readers. When we have a good accountability story, we get letters, we get calls, we get subscribers. I mean, when the Project Veritas story ran, it was very, very widely read, and we had hundreds and hundreds of handwritten letters from readers thanking us for our work and talking about the value of investigative reporting and the importance of it to, to our country. And I mean, you can really sense the appreciation that's out there for it right now.
I think Marco in Lawrence, Maryland wants to join that chorus. Marco, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, Laurel, Maryland. Yes, I'm actually visually impaired, and I recently got in the last year and a half or so, got a subscription. I read it every day. I think you guys are really helping to preserve our democracy. I think our system is under attack in ways that I haven't seen in my lifetime, which I guess goes back to, the first president I remember was Nixon. I think this is far greater because of the foreign component in that, and I think the Post and others are doing a fantastic job. That's really all I have to say.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for your call, Marco. Here is Dara in D.C. Dara, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Thank you, Kojo. I want to commend your guests for the phenomenal work in investigation and bringing this to our awareness. My comment is to that kind of time trade-off that we talk about editorially and the quote attributed to a number of people that what's urgent is not necessarily the most important and what's most important is not necessarily the most urgent. In terms of not analyzing politicians but analyzing policies and the deliberative decision-making process that, you know, a function the Congressional Research Service has performed, for example, historically, is there room in investigative reporting for in advance of something happening, helping create a more literate, especially science-literate, numerate public within this investigative space?
Glad you asked Eric Rich that question and not me.
Well, I was going to throw that at you, Kojo.
Right, thanks.
I think there's room for a tremendous amount of investigative reporting of different varieties. I mean, the space that we're in on my team is specifically writing about targets and topics that are already in the news in some way that people have deemed important, and there's an unanswered question that that's out there, and we see a reporting path to it. So I'm not sure this answers your question, but just thinking about how my team operates, you know, one of the things we try to do is regularly ask ourselves, like, what don't we know about something that people are talking about right now, and we know there's an actual answer. So why did Rand Paul's neighbor attack him so viciously? You know, there was an answer to that, and there's a way to find it, which is, you knock on the doors of his neighbors and you talk to the police sources if you can contact them and things like that. So that's sort of how we approach our story origination and how we frame the mission of the team.
You started in journalism, Eric, as an intern at the Middletown Press in Connecticut, your hometown paper. Do you think that the road you've taken, where you start at a small local paper, work your way to a national publication, is still a viable path for young journalists today?
It is, but it's not the normal path.
They have more options now.
They have a lot of options, and there are, people coming in on different kinds of tracks, and young people coming directly into the Post. And it felt like there was when I started, a much more rigid career path that started. I started as an intern collecting land transfer records and marriage license information and collecting that into agate for the Middletown Press to publish. Back then it was small paper, local desk of a bigger paper, local desk of a still bigger paper, and then onto maybe a Washington beat or some investigative beat or whatever your goal was. Now there are people coming in through, in particular, all these very important social media jobs that we have at news organizations today that really help us both see what people are talking about and see what's happening in the world, but also, find ways to promote our stories and connect our readers with our coverage. And those folks are not people, the folks who we're hiring anyway at the Post for those jobs tend not to be people who've spent, 10 years at the Hartford Courant.
Have time for one more. Here's Chris in Washington. Chris, your turn.
Hi, thank you. My question is, it seems like you guys, I'm trying to understand the balancing of the amazing investigation work on the, national politicians and their behavior. But here locally in D.C., it seems like that seems to be left behind. For example, like Jack Evans and his conflicts of interest with the Finance Committee on the Council, Kenya McDuffie and the displacement of Brooklyn Manor folks, hundreds of black families.
You're talking about the extent to which there's investigative work being done on the Metro staff, which I'm pretty sure is not a part of the rapid response team at this point, but Eric might have some.
But I can speak a little bit to that. Sure. I mean, Emma Brown is on my team, and she was on the education team and on the Metro desk for a long time and did some of the stories in recent weeks that we've been reading about D.C. schools and some of the problems there. So I would say we're still investigating. We're still doing a lot of investigating in locally. Also, Jack Gillum is on my team. I mean, this didn't turn out to be a blockbuster investigation, but after one of these red line derailments a few weeks back, he got the audio of all the scanner traffic between the trains and the dispatchers, and turned it into transcripts and analyzed it to look for other instances of times when train operators were unable to reach the dispatchers or vice versa for some reason or another. You recall that problems with the radios in the metro has been a longstanding issue. So, so we're committed to that, and the Post is committed to it, and I'm happy for the Rapid team to partner with them just as with the local staff, just as we would partner with the World Desk.
Betty Robinson sent us an email saying, I followed the Roy Moore stories and I'm confident that the prize won by the Post was much deserved.
Thank you.
Eric Rich is editor of the Washington Post Rapid Response Investigative Team. And let the record show that I think a career that starts by looking at land transfers in Connecticut is an excellent way to understand the diligence required for investigative reporting.
Thanks, Kojo.
Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Kojo Namdi.
Thanks for listening to the Kojo Namdi Show, and if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.